Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. On Building Bridges, American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and the Making of the Beat Generation with Jonah Raskin, author, professor, and chair of communication studies at Sonoma State University.
And first, the inimitable voice of Allen Ginsberg.
Howl for Carl Solomon. One. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night. Who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats, floating across the tops of cities, contemplating jazz. Who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs illuminated. Who passed through universities with radiant, cool eyes, hallucinating Arkansas and Blake-like tragedy among the scholars of war. Who were expelled from the academies for crazy and publishing obscene odes on the windows.
The wonderful strains of iconoclast, revolutionist in so many ways, the poem of Allen Ginsberg.
And we would have preferred to play a little bit more of Allen Ginsberg.
Well, why didn't
actually.
We, Ken?
Well, it's getting kind of rough out there in terms of the FCC, and it's getting kind of rough out there in terms of saying certain things over the air, and that's kind of the atmosphere that maybe Ginsberg was rebelling against back in the 50s also. So we didn't want to put the license at jeopardy, but we did want people to hear Allen Ginsberg because we're going to be talking a lot about him on this show.
Indeed, we are really. That was a very, very small clip from Allen, the poem Howl, a poem that broke apart the reality of hypocrisy, that forged new ground. And what a tragedy that the poem might be considered obscene when, as Allen would have said, and certainly we will, that the society has elements of obscenity, and so does the FCC for that matter. But indeed, we had to fade it down. And we're going to find out a lot more about the poem, and I'm very pleased to have with us Jonah Raskin, author, professor, and chair of communication studies at Sonoma State University. Welcome.
It's good to be here. So like many people of my generation, Howl was a poem that helped liberate us and break us out of the conformity and regimentation of the 50s and the whole mindset of the Eisenhower years. And it just was, there was a sense of joy and recognition and encouraged so many people in personal liberation and also in political liberation. Many people who went south to take part in the civil rights movement brought Howl was a kind of manifesto. It was a cultural manifesto, an encouragement to defy what Ginsberg called Moloch, the all-powerful society or seemingly all-powerful society of war and machinery and technology and soullessness and poetrylessness. And Ginsberg grew up with an awareness of America as a nation that went around bombing other countries. So I think what has happened, the United States bombing Iraq, and would not be news to him. I think his earliest poems from the 1930s were, well, not the United States bombing, but bombing of Madrid and Guernica and Spain and the fascists bombing the Spanish government. And he sort of went through life being aware of American military intervention all around the world. And around the time that he was writing Howl, he was certainly aware of the CIA involvement in Iran and toppling the government and toppling the Guatemalan government, working on behalf of United Fruit. So Allen Ginsberg was a very local poet. He was a very New York poet. He spent much of his life on the Lower East Side, but he was also a very global poet, and he had a really sense of the whole world and making connections with people in all different cultures and all different climes. And I think he has a really important legacy to this day.
I really want to thank you for, and Mimi also, for thinking of this show, because it's been probably 25 years since I've read Howl, and I sort of had a memory of it as being sort of rebellion, but not really very political, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, my memory of it. And when I reread it recently in preparation for the show, I was just like, really, wow, this is really a very political work. It's not just a reaction to a very closed society. It's not really like drug-induced stupors and stuff, you know. But this is a very political work, not only political but sociological rebellion, and it's really very powerful. It's much more powerful than I remembered it as being in any event. Mm-hmm.
Well, good. I'm glad that it still, no, I mean, still lives.
Oh, but it does. It yeah. does. And that's precisely it. And the book lives, too. And I don't know if the book lives through it or it through the book or they kind of intermesh. But one of the things that fascinates me, Jonah, about the book and the poem is, again, the fusion, the reality that art is political and politics are art, because there still is that tendency to kind of bifurcate, to compartmentalize, to think that somehow politics is over here and that art is over here. And the fusion that was Allen Ginsberg, and I think certainly the later years of Allen Ginsberg from the 60s forwards, was that fusion of kind of living poetry and then poetry reflecting that life.
There have been people in this country, I think it might be a uniquely American kind of point of view that poetry and politics are separate, because if we look all around the world at great poets from Neruda to Nazım Hikmet to Bertolt Brecht, they are poets who have fused poetry with politics, and Ginsberg saw himself as part of that tradition. He was at Columbia University in the 1940s, an undergraduate there at a time when people who taught literature emphasized the notion that it was in a kind of space all to its own.
Lionel Trilling taught him at that point, right?
Yes. And the especially people who are teaching poetry, if you read a poem, you were just supposed to read the poem. You weren't supposed to know anything about the social historical context or the poet's life. And I think in some ways that was a rebellion or reaction to in the 30s, there certainly was a tradition of in the United States of radical writers who saw themselves speaking for downtrodden, the people who were outcast and not part of American society. And Ginsberg was raised in a family that was highly political. His father was a socialist. His older brother was named Eugene after Eugene Victor Debs. His mother was a member of the American Communist Party. And when he went off to Columbia in 1943, his first idea was to become a labor lawyer. So I have a beef with Dana Joya, who's the director of the National Endowment for the Arts, who wrote a book called Can Poetry Matter? And didn't say a word about Allen Ginsberg or the Beat Poets, who really did make poetry matter to people all over the world. In this country, Howl has been translated into more than 30 languages, into Hungarian and Japanese and Chinese and Spanish and Dutch. It in the 50s and 60s, it certainly did play a role with young people in Latin America and Eastern Europe, as well as in the West, who wanted more freedom and were defying authoritarian regimes.
Yeah. I saw Howl I did years ago and still do as providing a license. It's an enabling poem for many of us to cut us out of not only the confines of convention, but in many ways out of the confines of fear.
Yes.
When you and I were briefly speaking off air, we were talking about how in times of repression or the constriction of civil liberties or conservatism, the Cold War era, people either can be further entrenched.
Yes.
And become more conservative. There were the Lionel Trillings and the Elia Kazans and so on, or they can burst forward. They can blossom. They can tilt at the windmill of oppression, or perhaps that's not the best metaphor, but break loose.
Yes.
And really flower.
Yes.
We've even seen that recently in those poets who initially were invited to the White House by Laura Bush and then refused to behave, and decided to speak against the invasion of Iraq, and now have formed a society of some great political poetry that has just really enhanced us all. And that was part of what I always saw Howell doing, as I said, becoming an enabler to come forward.
I think that in writing Howell, Ginsberg got in touch with his own deeper feelings and ideas and values and broke some of his own taboos, some of his own fears of things that he couldn't say, and was able to talk about homosexuality, was able to talk about communism, two things that you weren't supposed to talk about in the age of McCarthy and McCarthyism.
How was Howell received back, when was it, 1955?
It was read in 1955 for the first time at an art gallery in San Francisco called the Sixth Gallery. And Michael McClure, who was there, has described very movingly the impact of how he said many people, including himself, felt that they were living under martial law in the United States. And here was a poet who was making a direct attack on the state of martial law. Ferlinghetti was in the audience and said, I want to publish this poem. It was published in 1956. It was attacked in almost all of the leading literary journals of the time, in Partisan Review, in the New Republic. It was by many of Ginsberg's former undergraduate friends from Columbia, who, for not being a perfect, clean poem, for being a kind of messy, loud, angry poem that wasn't pretty.
You know, it's funny, there's right before me here, right from City Lights Books in San Francisco, where the first reading took place, Howell and Other Poems by Allen Ginsberg, Unscrew the Locks from the Doors, Unscrew the Doors Themselves from Their Jams. What a great
what
sentiment.
What I had to do to find that copy.
I know. And not only that, but of course, you know, we'll have to ask our program director, but how I would love for this station to have a reading, because there never has been a reading over the airwaves to this date of Howell. We can see all forms of obscenity and maiming and murder and objectification of the body, etc., but a great work like this we have still never been able, for fear of FCC regulation, to read.
And Allen was always, till the day that he died, he was upset that he couldn't read Howell and he couldn't read America on a radio station because of FCC rules. There's the line in America, go blank, blank yourself with your atom bomb. he was very much attuned to language. And you read the quote from Walt Whitman. And also in the late 40s and early 1950s, Walt Whitman was not taught. One of the great American poets, Walt Whitman was blacklisted. I mean, he'd written Leaves of Grass in the 1850s, but he was regarded as somebody who, he was not a T.S. Eliot. He was too rough. He was too working class. He was too undisciplined.
It's okay to be a fascist, but you can't be an American populist.
Well, or at least a neoconservative. You can go to the Church of England. You can wear a suit and tie and work in a bank. And you can like the King and Queen of England, but if you like Abraham Lincoln and you identify with the Union cause, forget it.
And I know you're going to read a piece from your book for us, if you would be so kind. And we are speaking with Jonah Raskin, who was a friend of, who very much lived this period himself, is an excellent writer and communicator, and has written American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howell, and the Making of the Beat Generation. Jonah?
I was going to read a bit from the first chapter, which is called Poetical Bombshell, and that's a phrase from Gary Snyder describing the reading at the Sixth Gallery, that it was going to be, I mean, this was an era where people were obsessed with bombs and atom bombs and nuclear bombs and blonde bombshells. And so they wanted a poem to have this real impact. And this is a part where the section is called Under Wraps, and where I'm describing the cultural and political situation in which Allen Ginsberg wrote Howell. The sixth gallery reading was a direct and deliberate response to the culture of the bomb and to American power and wealth. To understand the cultural and political significance of the reading, it might be helpful to look at the United States in the era after World War II, an era that profoundly shaped Ginsberg and the Beat writers. Like On the Road and Naked Lunch, Howl was a product of the Cold War. During World War II, American writers were on the whole enthusiastic about the global battle to defeat fascism. Most novelists, poets, and playwrights were patriotic and optimistic. Some worked directly for the government at agencies like the Office of Strategic Information. Others wrote literature that celebrated American democracy. Allen Ginsberg was only 17 in 1943, but he cast himself as the voice of his generation, and in high school wrote poetry that looked forward to the defeat of the Axis powers and the birth of a better world. When the war ended in 1945, there was a sense of euphoria and liberation among writers and intellectuals, as well as in the population as a whole. The troops came home. Families were reunited. Overt U.S. government censorship ended. The promise of peace and prosperity at home instilled an infectious sense that a new day was dawning. The euphoria was short-lived, however. In the aftermath of the war, citizens began to realize that the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki not only had ended the war, but also had ushered in a new and frightening era. The horrors of the German concentration camps were revealed, the Iron Curtain descended on Europe, and the Cold War began. As Americans became more aware of the dark side of the post-war era and the dark side of humanity, too, the mood in America shifted and writers reflected it. It was the era of the noir novel and film noir. So that's a sense there. Maybe a little bit further on, World War II and the war economy generated by the Cold War and the Korean War created a new class of American millionaires, a Babylonian plutocracy, Tennessee Williams called it. A small circle of writers enjoyed financial success, but most had to struggle just to survive. The American elite was grossly affluent, Williams noted, and it should have exhibited a bit more concern for the fate of its young artists. In the midst of unprecedented prosperity, American culture turned increasingly commercial, and writers turned increasingly to conformity. After an extensive visit to the United States, the British author Stephen Spender wrote in 1949 that authors like Henry Miller and Kenneth Rexroth were the last remnants of a race of independent writers. So I think there's some... I mean, America, we've got a Babylonian plutocracy all over again here. We have young writers who are doing everything they can just to survive. We have a society that's ignoring so many of the creative people. I think that in times when there's cultural repression, there are some people who are silenced. There are some people who are creative who think of how to get around FCC regulations or how to get around the blacklist. I know that Sid Caesar, who did our show of shows, the comedy show on television, would say that you weren't allowed to talk about politics or religion or sex, the rules. And so to figure out how do you say what needs to be said in a repressive climate. And Ginsberg certainly was aware of that, and it brought out a lot of his creativity to be able to speak and express himself, to talk about homosexuality, to talk about rebellion and defiance when there was the demand to celebrate America as a great power. And Ginsberg did see what he called the fall of America. You were talking about American democracy. He looked back to Whitman's America and saw that was a time where there was a great promise of democracy. And in the 50s, he was very sad about what seemed like the decline of America as a democratic society.
I can't help but just maybe veer a little bit away from the book, given your particular insights and involvement with people like Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Jack Kerouac and Ginsberg, and indeed the writing of this book, and your involvement with the Yippies. I mean, how do you place yourself, or how do you place the Ginsbergian reality as we look at where we are culturally today, and clearly the serious narrowing of our fundamental liberties, our forms of cultural and political expression. You were one of the founders of the Yippies. For everybody who might not know the Yippies, it was, how can I say, it was certainly a free-wielding, rambunctious organization that looked at the core of U.S. powers, but there was a creativity and a culture about it. How do you view things today?
I think that what the Bush administration...
Particularly, I should say, as we kind of gear up for the Republican National Convention in New York.
Right. Well,
there's one thing what the Bush administration is doing. I mean, closing a newspaper in Iraq, I mean, that's outrageous. I mean, talking about America, extending American democracy to countries around the world, and then padlocking a newspaper, it's outrageous. But we know that there are people who are organizing in Iraq. And I think very much the same is happening in the United States, that there is an attempt to crack down, to silence, to frighten people. And it does happen, but I know that all around the country there are people who are... have been inspired to be creative, to organize, to defy Bush. There's certainly on radio stations, on alternative newspapers and magazines, there are voices of many people who are speaking out against the conformity, against the repression. You can go to any city, almost any city in the United States, and find a community of people who are not being cowed. And I think that Ginsburg was important for me. I grew up on Long Island. I was a teenage beatnik.
So is Ken.
well, not really. I read Kerouac, but I really didn't.
And there was a kind of continuum. I mean, there is a long, wonderful, honorable tradition of nonconformity and protest in the United States that goes back from before the Beats. But in my own lifetime, from the Beats to the hipsters and the hippies and punk rockers and rappers. I mean, the poetry was not even in Ginsburg's day. Poetry was not even supposed to be. You weren't supposed to get up and read poetry. You're supposed to sit in your armchair and read it to yourself. So people today who get up on stage and perform their poetry, and the audiences are involved and it's alive. That is a lot the legacy of Allen Ginsberg. I teach a law class, a First Amendment class at Sonoma State University, and we do a reenactment of the Howell trial. And we're going to be doing it in about 3 or 4 weeks. And the trial is still very much alive, and the students relate to it. And I think people, young people nowadays, Ginsburg was a long time ago, but I think that there's a way that they understand a kind of instinctive way what he was saying and the situation and how it reverberates with their own lives today.
But, of course, he wasn't a long time ago, because the reality is if you just pick up Howl by Allen Ginsberg, it is alive, it is vital, it is almost at times painfully prophetic, and is also extremely satisfying because it's got some of that in-your-face America, and it distinguishes between the America of government and elite classism and the America and promise of America that is those who really create the wealth. Jonah, we're going to let you quickly take us out. So why don't you give us a few last sentences or thoughts?
Well, I love the language of how, I mean, he talks about listening to the crack of doom on the hydrogen jukebox. Somebody said that poetry is news that stays news. I mean, that's one of the lines in the poem that seems to me as much news today as it was then, listening to the crack of doom on the hydrogen jukebox.
Wow. That's a great line.
Everybody get this book and get Howl. And actually, getting Howl is easy. Just go to search engine and type in Howl and you'll get it.
So the book is American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl and the Making of the Beat Generation with Jonah Raskin. And I should say the writing is cogent, the writing is digestible, and it's formidable in its own right, as well as what it says about the poem Howl by Allen Ginsberg.